Hey, this is Dr. Howard Gurr for The Shrink Is In, and today my guest is Dr. Robert Reiner, Executive Director and Founder of Behavioral Associates. He's been practicing psychology since 1981, and he's well known for treating anxiety and phobias through biofeedback and virtual reality therapy. Reiner, welcome to The Shrink Is In.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
I'm glad to have you. So, Dr. Reiner, as far as I know, you've been using VRT, virtual reality therapy, for many years. In fact, I believe you're one of the first to use it in a clinical practice outside of universities and hospitals because it was so ridiculously expensive. So, how'd you get interested in virtual reality therapy?
Well, let me say that I was one of the first, but certainly not the first. There have actually been people doing it for a couple of years before I did. That's just because I hadn't heard about it. But, you know, I remember as being a graduate student in 1979 and learning about a technique called systematic desensitization, which every psychologist in a behavioral program knows about.
Correct.
It was a procedure to treat phobic anxiety developed by a guy named Joseph Volpe, who was a South African psychiatrist. He had this theory that by having people imagine what they were afraid of and then getting them into a deeply relaxed state using relaxation training, that pairing of the phobic situation in your imagination, the idea being that if you pair it with something deeply relaxing, that would unravel the learning that took place and actually rewire the brain, making new connections, which would be pairing the phobic situation, let's say it's flying, so you're on a plane, but now you pair flying with something deeply relaxing. And that made sense to me. It certainly made a lot more sense than some of the other psychological theories I'd heard. But I remember thinking to myself at the time, you know what, at least from what I knew about human nature, nobody is going to generate meaningful imagery about something they spend their whole life avoiding. It just seemed contrary to human nature. Mm-hmm. And I remember at that time saying to myself, you know, if something like virtual reality ever became available, it would confirm this guy's theory, and that would change our profession. And 20 years later, my wife said to me, turn on CNN, and sure enough, there was a piece on some pioneering psychologists. In this case, it was on the West Coast, who were doing virtual reality to cause desensitization. And, I've always been a gadget nut. I got very interested in biofeedback myself as a grad student and was doing it all through the late 70s and 80s. I mean, I had biofeedback equipment before I had a license to practice psychology. I did it as a postdoc, actually. And I've always been a believer in that kind of empirical stuff. So it seemed natural to pair it with virtual reality. I couldn't imagine doing anything different and was kind of shocked that most psychologists were not advocating biofeedback along with it. It just seemed like, ham and eggs.
It's interesting because I started using biofeedback in 1972. Mm-hmm. As an undergraduate, it was like my research project. It was a terrible project. And the whole theory was working on increasing alpha wave production mm-hmm. to increase relaxation. Mm-hmm. And the equipment was terrible. And I really got very limited results. But at that time, it was considered parapsychology.
Pretty much. And it was a self-inflicted wound. Because mm-hmm. a lot of the early claims were overstated, and when the backlash hit, they deserved it. We deserved mm-hmm. it. But, now modern biofeedback and even virtual reality is based on academic learning theory, which is why I think that I don't get why, to me, a psychologist not doing biofeedback is like a physician without a prescription pad.
Mm-hmm.
Academic learning theory is something that we developed as psychologists, and this is all about operant conditioning. Modern neurofeedback relies on Skinnerian or operant conditioning. And, you know, the stuff that's coming out now with computers behind everything is just outstanding. The neurofeedback stuff with Z-score training is incredible for biofeedback and neurofeedback. But the virtual reality produces, I think, the gold standard because it's pure exposure therapy.
Correct.
And you can completely control the environment. You know, if somebody had a fear of flying in the old days, we'd have to either get good video from the plane. I can't tell you how many flights I've almost been thrown off of because I was videotaping. Mm-hmm. And with virtual reality, you can actually control the environment. You can create thunderstorms. You can create turbulence. You can land the plane or take the plane off whenever you want. Because, you know, different people have different things they're afraid of. So you've got to customize your treatment to your patient. Not everybody fears the takeoff. Some people fear the landing. You know, you learn, if you work with phobic people, you learn there's no rhyme or reason to it at all. It just seems to happen. It's like it comes out of nowhere. I mean, we treated somebody who couldn't be in a car that made a left turn. Someone we treated, there were certain words that caused a panic attack. So, you know, why it happens is a glitch in the nervous system. Why it's maintained is a whole different story. It's maintained because of basic laws of learning.
Correct. So you see VRT really working well for these patients. Is that because we don't have to rely on imagery anymore? Is that because we can control the environment? Is it because we have better empirical data at this point, or is it a combination of all those factors?
Yeah, it's a combination of everything you just stated. But, you know, if you think about it, it's based on an inoculation approach. You know, when you get an inoculation, like a flu shot, the idea is you get a small dose of the disease, which is what a flu shot is. Your body defends it. So when it's actually exposed to it, your body's had prior experience with the defense.
Right.
This is called stress inoculation training. We teach the person to defend the body or to experience the phobic situation without anything bad happening. In fact, we pair it with something good. That's what the heart rate variability is. But, you know, basically, you experience what it is that you're afraid of, and the sky doesn't fall, and you internalize that, so new bonds are formed in your brain. This is all about the amygdala. You know, the primitive part of our brain. That's why people laugh who hear about these, like there are flying programs, for example, that will teach you all about the physics of the wing of a plane and stuff like that. To me, that's a waste of time because, you know, it's like the old saying, you can plan all you want until you get punched in the mouth. Well, that's what it's like with phobic anxiety. It has nothing to do with the frontal lobes of the brain. In fact, the frontal lobes get hijacked by the limbic system. And it's the limbic system, the emotional brain, the lizard brain that is running the show when you're having phobic response. That's why you have to finesse it or trick it, which is what virtual reality is. You're finessing the brain. But you can't deal with logic. It's you know, the part of our brain, you know, the quote, modern or new part, the frontal lobes, don't have a shot against the power of the limbic system. It's like a tsunami.
Yeah, I know. That's why when you try to, you know, give people rational reasons and explanations for why they're afraid of whatever they're afraid of, it doesn't work.
No, exactly.
And I've had some bizarre phobias over the years that literally the patient would say, I know it makes no sense. Mm-hmm. It's not even realistic. It doesn't even really matter. And yet I can't follow through. I can't face it. So.
What you just described is the most accurate description of what we hear day in and day out from people. Like the rational part of the brain knows better, but they can't help themselves from worrying about it.
Right. Because, you know, I always say to people, from my perspective anyway, as a psychologist, my point of view is always that all behavior is designed to protect the integrity of the individual.
Exactly.
So even if it makes no sense... Mm-hmm. Even from a non-phobic situation, from a regular psychological, situation that literally makes no sense to the person, I say, no, it makes no sense to you logically, but it's protecting you somehow.
Right.
And we have to figure out why that protection's necessary and whether we can get rid of it because it's really not important anymore.
Mm-hmm. It's not only not important, it becomes an impediment to the quality of your life.
Yeah. It does. So what are the most common phobias you work with in your clinic?
Well, this is self-selecting, of course, but the two most common phobias by far that we treat are public speaking anxiety.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can't give a speech in front of 50 people or even 5 people. So, you know, a person has to give a toast at their daughter's wedding and is paralyzed about it. So public speaking anxiety is, and then fear of flying. Those two probably make up 80% of our caseload in terms of, you know, using virtual reality. But, you know, fear of dogs, fear of cats, fear of driving is very common, especially if people have experienced a bad car accident.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, we get people who have fear of being in a car that's in the left lane or making a left-hand turn, you know, strange stuff.
Mm-hmm.
We had a guy, if somebody cleared their sinuses, would have a panic attack. He once got out of a taxi at 1 o'clock in the morning in a cold winter night out in the, in a rural area because the cab driver cleared his sinuses. He would actually hand out cards to people explaining why he didn't want them to clear the sinuses. But he would leave theaters, movies, if it was too much. So that was a strange one. We just finished working with a woman that had a fear of man-made submersible objects.
Really?
Yeah. She's actually a writer and wrote about it in Elle magazine. She wrote a very good article, too, as the patient.
Mm-hmm.
She had no explanation for how this happened. You know, the first thing you think about is when she was a kid, did she get her legs caught in some, you know, an underwater chain link or something, like a fence or something like that. But she couldn't recall. But, you know, mm-hmm. things like the chain of an anchor would terrify her.
Wow. Yeah. Sometimes it's hard to figure out what the initial trigger was.
You're right. And you know, usually you can't. And even if you think you can, there used to be a theory that if you had insight into why you were the way you are, that would somehow help you.
Mm-hmm.
But that's pretty much been disproven.
Right.
You know, I can walk off a curb the wrong way and break my ankle, and I know just how I did it, but still I'm going to get to an orthopod to set it properly. That's going to be my concern. What's the treatment going to be? Give somebody a skill or something to do.
I think it's easier when something is very concrete and clear, and I think it's more difficult when it's some kind of vague, amorphous symptom that you just can't put your finger on.
Yep, I agree.
So, like a broken limb is so clear and crystal and everyone sees it and you see it and it has a beginning and an end.
Mm-hmm.
But these phobias don't have an end in these people's minds. And then what I find is they tend to generalize. You know, my classic example is a guy who has some kind of GI issue and goes to a restaurant and has a problem with that restaurant. Not connecting that he has a gastrointestinal problem, IBS or whatever he has, and says, I'm never going to that restaurant again. But then, everyone says, well, let's go to this restaurant. And as he's starting to go to the next restaurant where he had no difficulties, he starts to think, well, what if I have the same problem? What if, I have to run to the bathroom? What if I feel sick?
Mm-hmm.
And now he starts to develop the anxiety of going to that restaurant, even though he's never had a problem there. And the next thing you know, he's not going out at all.
Yeah. I mean, at that point, it's gone from the initial problem to compliance with laws of learning.
Mm-hmm.
But think about it a different way. You know, you brought up a broken bone, and I agree with you. You're right. That's something that has a beginning, a middle, and end. You know what it is. But let's go back 500 years when you didn't understand that you broke your bone.
Mm-hmm.
And you just had pain there, but nobody knew what caused it.
Right.
Well, I mean, so that's how we're kind of in the dark about conceptualizing phobias. I mean, we're just at the beginning. We stumbled upon a combination of treatments that have yielded a 92% success rate without really understanding why phobias develop. I don't think that there are any theories that make complete sense to all the people that are doing research in this area. But the important thing is that you give people relief.
Right.
They don't have to suffer. Phobias are the most common type of mental health problem there is. And fortunately, there's treatments for it, so much so that it's considered by the NIH problem solved. They no longer fund research into curing things like fear of flying because virtual reality is considered the gold standard. And, you know, anytime you get over a 90% success rate for any kind of condition, it's considered we solved the problem. Now so it's a matter of how to generalize this stuff into the more subtle areas. Go on, I just cut you off. What were you going to ask me?
No, I was just going to ask you, you know, given that, where do you see virtual reality going? I mean, where's what direction do you see it taking?
Well, I mean, we have a set of protocols that we know are effective. So the model typically is, okay, let's branch it out and deal with the little more subtle kind of mental health issues of exposure. Mm-hmm. And I think that's where the more sophisticated types of virtual reality are going to combine with psychotherapy, especially cognitive behavior therapy. We're just seeing the beginning of it right now.
You know, there are certain, obviously, platforms and programs that create these environments that we use in dealing with patients. But every patient's really kind of different. And my sense is that if we could, on the fly, modify the environment to the person's unique circumstances, like the Star Trek holodeck, remember that one?
Yeah.
Where, you know, you could literally create the environment on the fly.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, when someone has a problem, you know, let's say with a particular road or a particular car, a particular person or particular circumstance, that you could say, okay, tell me, what does that person look like? And we could just modify it. And, or what is that environment? Or, you know, how high do you have to be? Whatever. So that we could actually create the environment that meets that individual patient's needs, as opposed to like a, you know, kind of a ballpark generic version.
Yeah, I think what you just described is the blueprint for a great idea. We've learned more in the past 5 or 10 years about the human brain than we did in all the years that preceded it. And we now know the brain is far more neuroplastic than we used to believe. And it actually gets reformed by the environments we expose it to. So how right. you spend your time and who you spend your time with actually does count. Confirming mm-hmm. another old wives' tale. So, you know, the company you keep does determine who you are and how you function in far more complex ways and powerful ways than we used to believe. So you can actually change the wiring of your brain in a negative way. And to resolve the problem, you have to reverse engineer it.
Mm-hmm.
And that means rewiring the person's brain, and one tool for that is virtual reality.
So my idea about this tailor-driven virtual reality,
I think it's a great idea. I think that you know, we've stumbled onto this incredible treatment protocol, and very powerful, because you know the way our brains are wired, you know, we've got this 2 to 3 pound piece of meat sitting in our skull that has no direct contact with the outside world, only through our senses. And, mm-hmm. you know, we know, for example, that people that are blind from birth, the audio cortex, the temporal lobe, has much more sophisticated maps and wiring because people come to rely on sound so much more, or a sense of touch. People that read Braille, they're, mm-hmm. The parts of the brain that are responsible for that are really light up when, you know, in this case, it's the motor cortex area, the sensory motor cortex area, lights up. And in people that don't use Braille, it's far more diminished. So, you know, I can't wait to see where all this is going. I do believe that something called augmented reality may mm-hmm. eventually eclipse virtual reality. Augmented reality is seeing the world as you see it with windows on top of it.
Right.
Tom Cruise did a movie about that years ago. I can't recall the name, but that way you're not shut off from the outside world the way you are with the virtual reality, which I think is one of the drawbacks to it, is you're completely in a different world,
mm-hmm.
and you have no connection to the world that we normally inhabit. You know, what I was saying earlier about the brain and, you know, kind of sitting in the skull with no direct contact, so we rely on our senses to deliver information, and virtual reality is based on the idea that if you give misinformation, then mm-hmm. there is therapeutic value to that if it's done the right way.
Right.
We did some work where we took burn victims, and, you know, the most horrible thing about the horror of being burned, if you're hospitalized, is getting your wounds cleaned. It's excruciating.
Right.
And there have been reports about 70 to 80% reduction in reported pain by putting people into virtual reality, into a cold, icy bath, or having a person sit in snow. And that poses an incredible distraction.
Right.
Remember, the brain is only looking at things one way. Now, think about those photos you see, where if you look at it from one angle, it's Marilyn Monroe, and the other one, it's Albert Einstein. It's never anything but one of those two. There's no middle ground for the brain in that sense. It's digital. It's either on or off, you see. There's kind of no middle area. So the brain ends up filling in stuff. Otherwise, of course, you know, we see the world, there'd be our optic nerve attaches to the retina, and there's a blind spot there. But the brain has a built-in replicator and fills it in, so none of us feel the blind spot. We also see the world upside down, and the brain turns it around.
Right.
You know,
it is very, very amazing and sophisticated.
It really is, and this is just the infancy stages right now. Wait 30 or 40 years, it's going to be incredible.
Yeah, well, unfortunately, I don't have 30, 40 years to give.
No, maybe you do. You have to wait for the singularity. When humans merge with machines.
Yeah. Anyway, unfortunately, we're out of time, Dr. Reiner. So I want to thank you for being a guest on the show, and thank you for the information. I hope my listeners appreciate it. And what I'll do is I'll leave your information below this on the podcast so people can contact you if they want your services in New York City.
Okay, sounds great.
So until next time, this is Dr. Gurr for The Shrink Is In.
You have been listening to The Shrink Is In, and your host has been Dr. Howard Gurr. If you want to learn more about Dr. Gurr, go to his website at